Hello and welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, an intimate conversation with Graham Swift, a very successful and lauded English novelist who's rather self-effacing, and whenever we've discussed his novels, he hasn't revealed very much about himself. But in his new book, which is a collection of non-fiction pieces he's written over the years, he lets us into the mind of Graham Swift, the writer. The book is called Making an Elephant, Writing from Within, and in many ways it's about how he came to be a writer, what being a writer means to the way you live, and about mentors, friends, and experiences he's had along the way. At the Times Cheltenham Literature Festival a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with Graham Swift in a tent, as you do at these events, and heard about his development as a writer, how he thought of himself as an outsider, and how he still does, and of his friendships with writers like Salman Rushdie, the man who came to Christmas dinner in disguise, and who Graham and his wife thought of as Father Christmas. Here's Graham Swift. Now, the title story, Making an Elephant, refers to a toy elephant you made as a boy for your father. Can you talk a little bit about why that's in the book and what happened in that story?
It's a toy elephant, or rather it was, although I still have it. And it was an elephant made of wood by myself when I was very small, sort of under the supervision of my father. And my dad, he died many years ago now, but when he died, I always knew that I was going to have to write about him because I'm a writer. It took, I should think, 10 years before the piece got written. And its central little story is about the making of this elephant. But my father was a very practical man. You might even have said he was rather unimaginative, but I think actually he had a lot of imagination. And he was very good at anything around the house involving woodwork, anything mechanical, car engines, all the things which I've always been hopeless at. I'm a head-in-the-clouds novelist. But there was this moment when, I don't know why, and I was very small, but I felt I had to pay some little tribute to my father's sort of handiwork skills, and I made this elephant, and there was a little final twist to this episode, which, looking back, it seemed to encapsulate a lot of my relationship with my dad, and to sort of turn round my standard perception of it. But perhaps I should explain that when my father died, back in the early 90s, one thing I did almost immediately was to go and see if I could find the house in South London where he had been a boy and had grown up. And I found it. It was in the terribly inspiring place called Lower Sydenham. And it was just a very ordinary two-up, two-down terraced house. It was like thousands of other houses. But it was distinguished, if you can say this, by the fact that in front of the house, you couldn't really call it a garden, in the space in front of the house, there were these two jammed together, derelict cars. And they'd obviously been there for ages. They were rusting. There was ivy growing up around them. And I sort of thought, well, had my dad seen this, he would either have found it a tremendous joke or he would have been quite horrified. But it was this vision of my father's former home with these cars in front of it that formed the starting point of this piece. And the piece is actually mainly about my father before I knew him. That's to say, during the Second World War, he was in the Navy. He was a pilot in the Navy, fighter pilot. He flew off of aircraft carriers most of the time, but there was a period, because of the sort of chances of war, when he was stationed in Africa, inland, in what was then called Kenya. And that's actually how elephants crept into this piece again. But perhaps I should read the little passage. Right. A small incident stands out from my childhood, and I still keep its physical relic. My father was the happy handyman that I could never be. And I became the willing pen pusher that he never was. And that's a reference to the fact that most of my dad's working life was spent in an office. He was a civil servant. But once, in spontaneous deference to his handyman skills and wanting to please him, I made a wooden elephant. He must have seen real wild elephants in Africa during the war. He must have looked down from his cockpit and spotted them lumbering through the bush, dipped his wing, and swooped to get a better view. But none of this would have occurred to me when I made my wooden one. Three pieces of thick plywood cut from a pattern with a fret saw. I was very good at twisting and breaking the blades. One for the body, head, and trunk, two for the legs either side. Glue them together, rub down the joints, and if you'd done the cutting well, you had an elephant that could stand up by itself. I didn't do such a bad job, and my father had watched progress keenly and encouragingly. But then the time came to paint it. What colour, he asked. Yellow? Pink? I found those suggestions ridiculous. Grey, of course. Elephants were grey, weren't they? He counter-argued, ready for me to choose from his impressive array of paint pots, but I just didn't get it. And so, grey it was. And that strange reversal stays with me still, as does the sad object of it all, that I should have been the realist and he the fantasist. It's not even a true elephant grey. It was the only grey then available, the one used in finishing off Airfix kits. Battleship grey. And as I stood, years later, outside his boyhood home, seeing those derelict cars, I thought, would he really have got this joke? Two cars just left to decay in the front garden itself gone rampant. Such things to him would surely have been sacrilege. And how I wish now that I'd painted it pink.
And as you said, you've still got this elephant.
Yes, I have.
And is it on your desk or near it?
I should have brought it with me, actually. It's very small. And very grey. But I still have it, yes. It's a very treasured object.
And when you look at it, what do you tell yourself about it? Is it a reminder to think pink?
It is partly that, but I think what I feel when I look at it is, my God, I once actually made an elephant. If somebody said to me now, here's some wood, make a toy elephant or whatever, I couldn't do it. It's something I've lost.
Well, you say you didn't think you were a natural writer, but that you had to make yourself one.
Yes.
So how do you mean you weren't a natural writer? We're talking about when you were quite young.
Yes.
What did you expect a natural writer was?
Well, this goes back to my father in a way again, and certainly to the circumstances into which I was born, which, if you have to classify it, I suppose it would be lower middle class suburban. I come originally from a semi-detached house right on the edges of the London suburbs in the 1950s. And that really meant that I sort of came off the conveyor belt of that time. I mean, families like the one I was born into were really being turned out by their thousands. And I think what they all wanted then was, in a way, to be like each other. They wanted to conform, they wanted to be conventional, they wanted security, safety. After all, there'd just been a war, and my father certainly knew all about that, and they wanted the opposite. So I was really born into circumstances which would not have led anyone to the somewhat insecure prospect of becoming a writer. There was no writer figure in my family, no one to point me in the direction of writing. So somehow or other, it just came from me. I mean, that's what I have to conclude. And I think it did come, it started at a very early age. And the only external stimulus would have been reading. I mean, back in the early 50s, at home, you listened to the radio or the wireless, or you read. And I think as a kid, I read a lot. I think at some point, you know, I would have picked up a book, whatever it was, and been enchanted by what was inside the covers. But I would also have done the extra thing, which not every boy or girl would have done, and said to myself, well, wouldn't it be wonderful to become one of the people who can create this magic inside the covers of a book? And of course, at that point, that was nothing more than a fantasy, a dream. I had no sense that I had any talent at writing. But somehow or other, it clearly was something which stuck. It became an ambition, it became a real desire, it became something I got very determined about. And eventually I made myself a writer, and I made this little dream that I had come true. And I have always felt that sense of having no particular ticket of admission to the world of writing, of being an outsider, of not belonging. And so having to look for ways into this world of writing, that still is with me. And I don't think it's a bad thing, because I'm not sure it's a good thing for writers to feel that they belong anywhere. You go your own way. And part of this was a feeling that maybe I was never a real writer. I mean, to come back to your question about the natural writer, and I had this feeling, well, there were some writers who were just born writers, and they could do it standing on their head, as it were. I wasn't like that. I could only do it by finding the writer inside me, and by a lot of work.
The way you're describing it, it almost sounds like you're shaping the elephant again from the block of wood.
Well,
you're,
yes.
You're
yeah.
finding the animal, the writerly
yeah,
animal. Well,
maybe the elephant in a way was me, you see. But I now feel quite strongly that the natural writer is really a bit of a myth. All writers can make themselves appear natural, but they do that by a lot of work. And in the book, there is quite a long piece about, partly about Greece, where I lived for a while, but about one writer who was very important to me. For a long time, I had never met a writer. I had never met anyone who had to do with writing. The only writers I could meet, and in a sense did meet, were writers I read. And one writer who was very important to me was a Russian writer called Isaac Babel, who I happened to read for the first time in Greece when I was travelling around very roughly before I went to university. And he made a big impression on me, and that impression was partly to do with a realization that he was not a natural writer, and that he had the same fear in a way that I was experiencing at that time. I was only about 18. But the people I met who were important for my writing for a long time they weren't real meetings, they were meetings through reading, but they had the force for me of real and important personal encounters. I could never have met Isaac Babel because he, like many Russian writers, he disappeared and died under Stalin in the late 30s, early 40s.
But you're talking about Red Cavalry, that
yes,
collection of his
yeah.
short stories,
yeah.
some of them very short, like a paragraph or two.
Extremely short, extremely strong, sometimes violent, very powerful writing, and sometimes very lyrical writing.
I think there's one, he tells a story of being a young boy and being in Odessa, and
yes.
There's a guy, like a Russian fisherman or somebody he's talking to on a pier, who's saying, you know, if you want to write, you can't write in Yiddish, you've got to write in Russian.
Yes.
Because Russian is a language for writing, and Yiddish yes. doesn't have enough interesting words about trees
yes.
and landscape.
Yes.
So
yes.
did that appeal to you, that idea that he even had to find a language to write in?
Well, he had to find a language. He also, rather extraordinarily, had to find a whole experience, a whole extreme experience, to fire his writing. I mean, he was actually a pretty intellectual figure. He was Jewish from Odessa. But during the post-revolutionary wars in the early 20s, he found himself serving with a regiment of Cossack cavalry in Poland. And this was something almost unheard of. And it produced these stories called Red Cavalry. And they are, in a way, the result of an extreme experience. Absolutely nothing like I've ever undergone.
Well, I was going to ask, did you feel that you had to put yourself in these kind of extreme
places? No, I didn't. But I felt a rapport with this man who, as I've learned more about him, clearly felt that he was not a natural. That's what I think drew me. I mean, his path to becoming a writer was obviously extremely different from mine. But there was a real connection.
On ABC Radio National, you're in The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, and you're listening to my conversation with Graham Swift at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Here he talks about mentors, literary friendships, and a particularly kind editor, Alan Ross.
Alan Ross, who's no longer with us, sadly, but he was for a long time the editor of a magazine called London Magazine. Going back now to the 1970s, when I was still this aspiring writer, I never had anything published, and at that time I was only writing short stories. I thought I would just be a short story writer. How you wrote a novel, I just didn't know. And I was sending off short stories to this place or that place. And I sent quite a lot to Alan at London Magazine. And I got a lot of rejection slips back. But somehow his rejection slips always carried a little note of hope about them. Because he would write, I can see his handwriting, he would say, almost this time, not quite, nearly. And he was like someone sort of gradually pulling me in. And I felt, oddly, that I knew him before I met him. And then the magic moment came where he said, yes, I'd like to publish this story. And I did meet him. He said, come and have lunch. And I had never met anyone like Alan Ross before. He was a writer himself. He was a poet. He was a journalist. Privately collected paintings. He just moved in a world which was not my world at all. I was a boy from South Croydon. He lived in South Kensington. And I went to see him, and you know, I describe all this in the book, but it was a wonderful combination of, as I think I put it, being both let in to a world and being let out. I was being let in the sense of I knew I was no longer alone as a writer. I had a sort of home. I was meeting someone who was a real friend, certainly to my writing. And I was being let out in the sense that for years up to this point, and I'm no exception, I think this is true for any struggling writer, it's as though you're in a box and you need letting out, and that box can almost start to feel like you're under a stone and you're going to stay there forever. And it's only at the moment when you get published that that lid, that stone, gets lifted. And Alan sort of lifted the lid at the same time as he sort of said, come in. And as you say, I associate him always with a particular drink known as a Negroni, which I'd certainly never drunk before I met Alan. It's a lovely little pink, rosy-coloured cocktail, quite powerful. And I always associate that with Alan, but I always associate it with the moment where I entered this world which I dared to think I belonged to, but I had not entered it before. It was a really wonderful man.
Do you feel like you belong to it now?
Well, I said I'm sort of half and half still. I mean, some people might say of me, I'm a quite established writer.
I think everybody would say that.
Somewhat ghastly phrase, isn't it? An established writer. But there's certainly a creature inside who doesn't feel that at all. Who's always, as it were, trying to establish himself. And I don't think that feeling will go away. It's what you get with everything you write. You are you're trying to achieve some position which you haven't achieved yet. That's how I think it is. And I suppose, in a way, all writers, all artists are terribly insecure people. And maybe I'm just talking about general insecurities. But the feeling of really belonging is not something I have 100%, even now.
You write about friendships, and I wanted to talk to you about that now, because you have a piece of you interviewing Kazuo Ishiguro, and you write of Carol Phillips, of Salman Rushdie, of Patrick McGrath. Tell me about how important these friendships are to you. Is it possible to have a really good friendship with another writer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hope I've proved that. And I hope the friends I have would sort of reciprocate that feeling. And you see, this is rather odd again, because I've just been saying there was a long time in my life I never met another writer. And I now have several good writer friends. I don't necessarily see them often, because some of them don't even live in this country. And this is one of many things I could never have imagined when I set out to be a writer, that I would, in a way, mingle with other writers. And one of the ways in which I think I've been very fortunate, I mean, probably my oldest writer friend is Kazuo Ishiguro, who I would have met. That was back, this is about 1982. There was a thing called the Best of Young British Novelists, and there have been several of these exercises since, but this was the very first one. And in order to qualify as young, you had to be under 40, which is quite generous. And there were 20 of us, and they include some now well-known names, including Kazuo Ishiguro. And I think I had met him before, but the thing I remember was we all had our group photograph taken by Lord Snowden in some kind of loft in Chelsea. And we all felt very uncomfortable. I can see us looking very nervous about this process. But it actually did us all a power of good. It was, I don't know what to call it, a promotion, I don't know. It was actually very successful, and people, even today, remember this. If they're old enough, they remember it. And I made contact through that with two or three other writers, including Kazuo Ishiguro. And I think the thing is that when we meet, we don't necessarily want to talk about writing. This is a very interesting paradox. I'm quite open to talking about writing with another writer. In fact, I value it when it happens, but I don't expect it. And I think that the same is true vice versa. Writers often need to get away from writing, and so when they're with another writer, there's a sort of recognition, oh yes, we do that thing by ourselves, but we don't want to talk about that now. Let's have a drink, let's talk about anything else. It's a strangely paradoxical, ambiguous kind of relationship, one with another writer. But I certainly have had some very, and continue to have some very good ones. I was lucky to meet Ted Hughes, and I knew Ted through fishing, not through writing. And when we were together. I don't think we had a single conversation about literature, about either novels or poetry. It was just taken for granted, and we went fishing, you know. And that was very refreshing. It's actually a wonderful way to meet someone who does the same thing as you through doing something different.
So when a friend publishes a book that you think isn't their best, how do you manage it?
Slightly unfair question.
Why is it unfair? I wouldn't want to ask you unfair questions, but explain why do you think it's unfair?
Well, because it's you are referring to what is often a very real situation, so it's not unfair at all. The situation feels unfair, is perhaps more the point, because if you are good friends with a writer, you certainly read their latest book, and I think a certain amount of honest criticism of it, if needed, if that's what you feel, is fine. But basically, if someone's, you know, if another writer has finished a book, to be honest, my principal instinct is to want to give them a big hug. For doing simply that, because I know from the inside that to write a novel is an enormous undertaking, and when you actually complete it, it's an achievement. In a sense, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent to the outside world, merely to have done this thing, to have got this thing from inside you and put it on the pages, is a rather staggering achievement. So when I know that this has happened with one of my writer's friends, I really do feel like, come here, you know. And thus, I don't particularly want to say, well, I had this or that reservation about such and such. It can be a rather tricky situation, it's true.
Do you show your friends your manuscripts before? Do you get their opinion?
No, I don't do that. I don't really do that at all. I'm not the kind of writer who shares anything before I feel the whole thing is there. Almost not until I get to a point where I feel, well, effectively, it's finished. I've done as much as I can do with it now. Some comment would be certainly very helpful, but there's nothing more I can do, so it has to be shown to other people. And my wife is the first person it would always be shown to. And she can be my toughest critic. But I'm not the kind of writer. I know there are many writers who are the opposite of this, who, you know, they like to say, I'm going to read you what I've written today. What a ghastly thing to do. I mean, apart from anything else, a terrible imposition on, you know, your wife or the person close to you who has to sort of listen to this stuff. I think, you know, you have to spare people that. But I know a lot of writers are more than happy to share work in progress. I keep it to myself, and then when it's almost there, I feel I can let it go.
English novelist Graham Swift in conversation with me, Ramona Koval, at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. You're in the Book Show on ABC Radio National, and here Graham Swift concludes our discussion talking about his friendship with Salman Rushdie.
Well, I knew Salman Rushdie a little. I met him before that extraordinary phase in his life where he suddenly had to go into hiding. But strangely, I got to know him much more, even quite closely, during that period of 10 years or so, when he had to live this extraordinary life. And he was often in my home with these kind of policemen with guns and stuff like that. And I was not alone, by any means, in being in that situation. I write in this book about a little ritual that kind of grew up, that my wife and I always spent Christmas with Salman and his wife, sometimes with some other people, either in our house or in a house which even now I cannot, you know, say anything about. I still want to keep it a secret. I mean, Salman is a very prodigious character. He's not always at his best in the situation which he most wants to be in. That's to say, he's a man who wants the biggest audience in the world. And when he has the biggest audience in the world, I don't think you always see him, in a way, for the real human being he is. But those Christmases were very small-scale, intimate and secret occasions. And so I was, you know, I was privileged to get to know him and recognize that whatever people say about him, he was a real human being in those days and still is, and he has great warmth, and he was very good company. And given the situation that he was in at that time, he kept his sense of humor amazingly. So I actually had a lot of fun with him and with others. And he became, this is really the gist of the piece, he actually became a sort of Father Christmas figure, because he would turn up with his entourage of special branch policemen who all got their bit of turkey and Christmas pudding. He'd turn up in disguise anyway. And I had started to feel, it's Christmas morning, we're waiting for this man. Surely this is Father Christmas is going to come. So bizarrely, in this strange period of his life, I've never told him this. He turned into the nearest thing to a real-life Father Christmas.
There are some fantastic illustrations in this book that I wanted to talk to you about, but also some poems. And I wanted perhaps you to read a poem and, mm-hmm. and talk about when do the poems come in this life of writing novels and other kinds of pieces?
Well, you're quite right. This book contains actually quite a long section of poems, which is definitely something new, certainly in publishing terms for me. And they all really derive from one rather strange period when I'd finished a novel. It was called The Light of Day. So I'm going back a few years. And when I finish a novel, I seldom have the germ of a next novel. And in any case, I feel exhausted. So there's a way in which I don't particularly want to do anything after finishing a novel. But for some reason, after finishing this book, there was either some sort of overflow or I somehow felt I had to keep my juices running. I wrote a poem very quickly. I wrote another poem and then another. And for months, I was writing just poetry, actually quite prolifically, I suppose. And then it all came to a halt as strangely as it began. And this may be because by then I had an idea for another novel. Anyway, I had all these poems. I shoved them to one side. I don't think I had any notion of publishing them. But when the idea for Making an Elephant, of a collection of pieces, started to evolve, I thought, well, if you're ever going to publish them, this is an opportunity. So I made a selection, and they're in the book. I'd hesitate to call myself a poet, but I have always felt that poetry isn't just a matter of verse. I think the novel can have a poetic element, and if people say of my novels, as they sometimes have, that there's some sort of poetry involved in them, either in sort of local language or in some larger structural sense, then, you know, I'm glad.
Would you like to read one?
Yeah. This one is called Allotments. I used to tease out the word before I knew what it meant. How could it be a lot when it looked so little? A strip of soil for beans or cabbages, a cold frame, a compost heap, hardly the earth. But look at the love that has gone into each. The careful rows of canes, the sheds magicked up from old offcuts, each one architecturally unique. Look at them here on Sunday afternoons, lost in their little worlds, I never knew what a lot meant, or a little. And then I was let in on the meaning. Allotment, it's what you get. It's what you're given to get on with. Didn't you understand? Your little patch, your little place, among all the others.
I did like that one. And also, I just want to show the audience this other lovely little illustration here at the back. It's fishing flies. And then when I look very, very closely, it's got GS 1994, I think. This is an artistic, another kind of artistry.
Well,
they are beautiful.
You see, I don't just make elephants.
No. This looks like very skilled, practical handiwork to
it. You can make a mystique of it, but it's not as difficult as it looks. Well, one thing I do apart from writing is occasionally go fishing. One thing you can do as a fisherman, even if you're not actually by the water, is to tie these flies, fly fishing. They are absolutely charming little objects by themselves, and perhaps particularly flies for salmon, because they can be larger and they can be extremely colourful in some cases. No one knows, by the way, why a salmon takes a fly, and it's much more important that the salmon is there and the fly is very near the salmon than what the actual fly looks like. But you can have a lot of fun tying up these special patterns, it's something I do from time to time. You can have a little kit and a little vise and various tools, and you make them from wonderful sort of confections of feathers, bits of fur, bits of tinsel, bits of silk, and you wrap them around the sort of hook, and if you're lucky something comes out which might even catch you a fish. But you were very sharp to see that little, I don't think it's advertised in the book, that those flies are actually ones that I tied whenever it was. 94, you say.
Please thank him for being with us this morning.
English novelist, poet, and as you heard, keen fisherman in conversation with me at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. His book is called Making an Elephant, Writing from Within, and is published by Picador.